Welcome to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker State Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox, back early on a Thursday morning. Good to be back in the recording seat again. I am about 2 weeks out from getting back from Australia, and I think last night I had my first normal night of sleep. Man, I'll tell you, it's been flying back across the international dateline has just wrecked me. I'm like an infant who doesn't know night from day on my sleeping habits. I've been waking up at 2:30 in the morning and been awake for hours. So it's just been killing me as far as trying to get a normal night's sleep and feel like a normal human being. So glad to knock on wood here. I'm hoping that I'm back on track because not very fun when you're not getting enough sleep. So today we're doing another reading from Never Sniff a Gift Fish, and this one is The Mountain Car. Budge Honeylip, proprietor of Honeylip's Auto Salvage and Junk Company, sold us the mountain car himself. As we said afterward, Budge was a man you could trust. Rhett Sweeney and I bicycled out to Honeylip's, prepared to deal with his head salesman and tow truck driver, Slick Beasley. Sure as shooting, old Slick will try to pass off one of those junkers Honeylip intends to sell for scrap iron, I told Rhett. Yeah, he said, you got to watch a man like Slick Beasley. Here's what we'll do, I said. As soon as Slick starts giving us the hard sell on some wreck, we'll just laugh cynically and start to walk away. Let me hear you laugh cynically, Rhett. Okay, that's not bad. Rhett and I had worked in the hayfields for nearly the whole month of June in order to earn enough money to buy ourselves a mountain car. Our transportation situation had become critical when both our respective set of parents had simultaneously refused to allow us to drive the family autos anywhere except on paved roads. They ranted some nonsense about mud and rocks and trees and branches and fenders and oil pans as their excuse. The problem was that our county didn't have all that many paved roads, and what there were didn't go anyplace interesting, such as to decent hunting and fishing areas. The crisis forced us to indenture ourselves to a series of farmers, every one of whom was possessed of a manacled obsession for extracting from his hired hands their last ounce of energy. If we much as stopped for a drink of water and a bit of conversation, the farmers would yell at us to stop goofing off because they didn't want their hay to get snowed on before Rhett and I got it in, which was ridiculous since it was still only June. Our suffering and exhaustion were almost too much to bear. Rhett and I each contracted a blister, in fact. When we showed our injuries to the farmer of the day, all he did was to laugh cruelly and say that it was so rare and strange for blisters to rise up for no known reason that he had mine to send it to Ripley's Believe It or Not. Farmers were an insensitive bunch. Having come by our money through such hard labor, Rhett and I were not about to be snookered out of it by some high-pressured salesman like Slick Beasley. By the time we had bicycled out Cemetery Hill Road to Honeylip's Auto Salvage and Junk Company, we had our plans laid. The main idea was to slip into the salvage yard and check out the cars before Slick even knew we were in the vicinity. That way, we would be able to arrive at our independent judgments without being confused by a barrage of sales talk. Everything went well until we started examining the first car, opening and closing its doors, looking under the hood, kicking the tires, gazing in wonder at the miraculously low mileage recorded on the speedometer. "Afternoon, gentlemen," a voice behind us. "Anything I can help you with?" It was Slick, calmly leaning against a rusty Packard, pretending to clean his fingernails with a penknife. "We're just looking," I said shrewdly. "Too bad," said Slick. "I happen to have a nifty little number here that runs like a dream." He slid into the car, started it, and gunned the engine into a banging roar. It sounded good. Slick shook his head as he turned the key off. "A rich banker in town is supposed to stop by at any time now and buy this vehicle for a spoilt brat of a kid. Oh, how I hate to see them rich kids get everything. Shucks, I'd sell this car right now for half the price just to prevent that from happening." "How much?" I asked. "Hunter," Slick said. Retch and I laughed cynically and started to walk away. Then Budge Honeylet popped out of his office in the company's Quonset hut. "Dang it all, Slick," he yelled. "I got a mind to give you the boot trying to foist a car like that off on these boys for $100. "But boss," blurted Slick. "Don't butt me," yelled Bud. "You get over to the shop and change the oil in the tow truck. Won't be nobody around here you can cheat out of their hard-earned money." Slick hung his head and slunk off towards the Quonset hut. I felt sorry for him, but he had it coming. Budge put his arms around Retch and me. "Now, you boys just tell old Budge the kind of vehicle you're looking for." "A mountain car."
"You mean, like for hunting and fishing?"
"Yeah, you know, the kind of car that will go just about anywhere."
"Oh, you don't want something fancy then, something with fenders and all that that might get caught up in the brush."
"Nah," Retch said, "it don't need fenders."
Budge said in that case he had just the car for us. A lot of his customers were picky, he said, and wanted fenders and all the trimmings on their car, but he could see that we are practical, down-to-earth, no-frills men. In addition to all the other qualities, Budge could judge character pretty well. The car he showed us had a bit fewer frills than we had expected. No seats, for example, a missing door, a glassless rear window, a lidless trunk, and of course, no front fenders. There were, we would discover, other missing frills, but their absence was not immediately observable. Budge set an apple box inside the car for a seat, climbed in, and started the motor for us. It sounded like a washing machine tumbling down a flight of stairs. Smoke billowed out from every crack and seam. Budge stuck his head out of the cloud of smoke. "Course it'll need a tune-up, cough, cough, but you two look like you might be pretty handy with tools. Seeing as how that ornery Slick tried to cough, cough, pull a fast one on you, I could probably let you have this for choke. Prime mountain car for, $40. We stared at him in disbelief.
$40 for this car? He had to be out of his mind.
Budge apparently was reading our thoughts because he started to say, "On the other hand, now that I think about it, maybe I could..."
"We'll take it," Retch blurted out.
"Yeah," I added quickly. "You said $40. You can't change your mind now." We could tell from the look of astonishment on Budge's face that he hadn't run into a couple of Sharpies like us in a long while. Obviously, when we realized what mistake he had made, he had thought about raising the price, maybe doubling it. He even as much as admitted his blunder after we had completed the transaction.
"I'll tell you something, boys. It ain't every day I sell a car like this one for $40.
Scarcely believing our good fortune, Retch and I loaded the bikes into the back of the car and were driving off when we saw Slick standing in the door of the Quonset hut, his mouth agape as he stared first at us, then back at Budge, then at us again. We decided to give our mountain car a quick road test on Cemetery Hill. The hill was by no means as rugged as the terrain our mountain car was intended for, but it was sufficiently steep and winding, as may be judged from the fact that the hill did not have a cemetery on it. The name had been invented by loggers who had to drive trucks down the steep, twisting grade. Our mountain car growled up the hill without difficulty, delighting us with its performance. At the top, Retch, who was driving, plowed the front of the car up a steep bank in order to get it turned around.
"Wow, look at that. This thing is just like a tank," he exclaimed happily. "Now let's see how it does going downhill."
One of the frills missing from the car turned out to be the brakes. Immediately, I saw why there was no door on the passenger side. Some passengers had undoubtedly kicked it off in its haste to abandon the car on a downgrade. Only two factors prevented me from leaping out. One, a fierce determination not to abandon my friend, and two, total paralysis. Sitting on the seatless floor of the car, I could look down through gaping holes and see the earth rushing past a few inches away. Even worse, on one turn, I could see rushing sky. Somehow, Retch managed to get down the hill without flipping us over. After we had coasted to a stop, we sat silent for a long while, savoring the sensation of breathing. Presently, a farmer drove up in a truck. He squealed to a stop and rushed over.
"You boys all right?"
"Yep," Retch said.
"You're lucky to be alive from the looks of it," the farmer said. "Your car is totally demolished."
Retch and I smiled feebly but appreciatively. It isn't everyone who can joke like that and still keep a straight face. Rhett and I drove the rest of the way to his place in low gear. The trip was without further incident, except that while we were waiting for a train to go by on a crossing, Sheriff McGrady's head poked through the smoke on my side. "I should have known," he said, recognizing me and Rhett. "What in tarnation have you two gone and done now?" "Just driving our mountain car home," I said. "Car?" the sheriff said. "There's a car here?" "Why, for goodness sake, so there is. What kind of fuel does it burn? Wet leaves?" "Now, I don't wish to seem unkind, lads, but if I catch you driving this vehicle on the public roads again, I'll skin the both of you." Sheriff McGrady had no great appreciation of mountain cars. Wretch's father was sitting on the front porch in his undershirt drinking a can of beer when we pulled up into the Sweeney driveway. "Well, what do you think of our new mountain car, Popper?" Rhett shouted. "We practically stole it from old Budge Honeylip for a lousy $40. Mr. Sweeney stared impassively. "Pat and me, we're going to get your tools and tear it down and put it back together, Popper. Of course, we'll need the garage, but I figure you can park your car out in the alley for a couple of days." Mr. Sweeney continued to stare impassively. I began to suspect that he had suffered a stroke. Then slowly his lips began to move. "Someday somebody will invent a pill," he said. Weird. Wretch and I attributed his muttering nonsense to a slight stroke or maybe temporary senility. We worked on the mountain car for a week, dismantling it piece by piece and arranging the parts in a neat order on the floor of the garage and down the driveway and around the lawn. Mr. Sweeney would come home in the evenings, park his car in the alley, stare balefully at us in the dispersed parts of the mountain car, and then go into the house muttering to himself about the invention of pills. The man was not well. My fellow mechanic and I were not feeling all that great either. Bit by bit, our confidence in being able to reassemble the car eroded. Panic started to set in. We began to quarrel. "The long gizmo with the holes in it bolts onto that other big thing over there," Wretch would say. "You're crazy," I'd yell. "The thingamajig with the flat doohickeys on it goes there." Nevertheless, the car was reassembled in a single weekend. All the gizmos and thingamajigs and doohickeys were bolted into their proper places with swift efficiency, if not actual frenzy. The work, however, was accompanied by a steady stream of creative cursing that turned the air of the neighborhood blue for weeks afterwards. Occasionally, Wretch's mother would come out to the garage and complain about the vile invectives rolling out from the bowels of the mountain car. "Hush," she'd cry, "the neighbors will hear." "I don't give a bleep if they do hear," Mr. Sweeney would reply. "Now hand me that box wrench, Wretch, and be quick about it." "Sure thing, Popper, but are you certain that whatchamacallit goes there?" "Shut up!" Mr. Sweeney did a wonderful job of putting the mountain car back together, and it was almost as good as before. He even repaired the brakes. To show our gratitude, we offered to take Mr. Sweeney along on our first fishing trip in the mountain car. His only response to the invitation was a long, quavering laugh that reinforced our doubts about his emotional stability. The mountain car provided us with enormous pleasure, hauling us to the very ends of wilderness roads and as often as not back again. We even gave the car a name, Mrs. Peabody, in honor of our favorite high school English teacher. Apparently, this caused no end of rumors about the teacher. For example, one day, Wretch and I were tossing back a couple of malts in Toby's soda fountain and discussing our favorite topic, the mountain car. "I think Mrs. Peabody's rear end is about to go out," I said. Toby froze in mid-wipe on a glass he was drying. "What makes you think so?" Wretch asked. Toby cocked his head in our direction. "Well, she was making these strange rumbling sounds when I had her out in the mountains the other day." "You had Mrs. Peabody out in the mountains?" Toby asked. "What for?" "The usual thing," I said. "Wretch and me take her out 2 or 3 times a week. Sometimes we stay out for days." "For days?" Toby said. "You and Wretch with Mrs. Peabody?" "Sure," I said. "It's more fun that way. Gosh, Toby, maybe you'd like to come along sometime, too. You'd be more than welcome." "I don't think my wife would like me going out with Mrs. Peabody." "Oh," Wretch said, obviously miffed. "You think you're too good for Mrs. Peabody. Just because she's old and shabby and got a few too many miles on her, you don't want to be seen out with us." "Goodness, no," cried Toby nervously, "and she's certainly not all that old. 35, I'd guess." 32, Wretch said with his temper cooling. "Sure, I'll admit Mrs. Peabody needs some work done on her. In fact, my pop says he's going to grind her valves first chance he gets." Toby's glass shattered on the floor. "Your father is going to grind her valves? I thought he was a bricklayer." "Yeah, he's a bricklayer, all right. but he's gotten so he enjoys tinkering with Mrs. Peabody out in the garage. It's sort of a hobby with him. Mumbling incoherently, Toby walked off to find a broom. It was obvious he didn't know much about mountain cars, so we never mentioned Mrs. Peabody to him again. Our adventures with Mrs. Peabody in the 2 years we owned her are too numerous to mention here, so I'll only recount the last. Rhett and I were grouse hunting with Mrs. Peabody up Big Sandy Mountain. As we were driving along, a big blue grouse appeared at the edge of the road up ahead. Rhett eased Mrs. Peabody to a stop on a turnout, and we grabbed our .22s and slipped out of the car. The grouse, in the meantime, had flown up into a spruce tree. Stealthily, we walked up the road, trying to pick out the dark shape of the grouse among the boughs. I inched around the far side of the tree, my rifle at the ready, but I still couldn't see the grouse. Rhett was still standing on the road, impatient as always. "Fire!" he said. "I can't see it," I whispered. "Why should I fire?" "Fire!" Rhett shouted. "Fire yourself, idiot, if you can see the grouse," I shouted back at him. "Forget the dang grouse," he yelled, taking off down the road. "Mrs. Peabody is on fire." Indeed she was. Although Mrs. Peabody had always smoked, now there were tongues of flame licking from the hood. We were too late to save her. The loss saddened us, of course, but there were others who looked upon it as a blessing. Among those was the Forest Service, whose lookout towers half a dozen times a summer would report Mrs. Peabody as a fire out of control. My mother, who referred to the mountain car as a death trap, was much relieved to hear of its end. Rhett's father could scarcely contain his joy. Budge Honeylip saw it as an opportunity to sell us another fine car, but perhaps the most relieved and delighted person of all was our high school English teacher. That concludes the mountain car. So I was thumbing through one of the other books that Patrick McManus puts out and or has put out, one of the many, and I was excited when I saw that there is a sequel to Mrs. Peabody or the mountain car, and it's called Mrs. Peabody 2, which I have not yet pre-read. So I don't know if I'll go into that one cold or if I'll pre-read it to see if it's worth reading for the podcast there, but I appreciate all the feedback you guys have been given. It seems like a lot of you guys have read Patrick McManus as a kid, or maybe your dad read it to you. A lot of great stories. In fact, I'll dig up some of the messages there just so that you guys can hear them, because they're really some great ones. Any case, I appreciate you guys hanging in there, and until the next one, hope you guys are getting your applications in for the Western draw that is coming up here rapidly. And with that, good luck in the draws.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Western Bowhunter podcast, please subscribe to the show so that you will automatically be notified when new episodes are posted up. Please take the time to give us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. This will help us in the podcast rankings and will help us grow. If you have a topic you'd like to hear about or a guest that you'd like to hear from in a future episode, email south@stalkerstickbows.com with podcast in the subject line.
Too many years are passing by. I've gone down.